Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
If you enjoy the Creative Control podcast and want to support it with a monthly pledge, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol. That's patreon.com/creativecontrol with two K's. You can pledge $1 a month or $4, $8, $30, $50, $100 a month, whatever you want. There are gifts and incentives to pledge, but more than anything, you can keep the show going. There's no other revenue stream for this podcast. I've been doing it for my own fulfillment and to contribute something to the culture. But I think it's time to see if I can generate some kind of salary from all of this work. So, if you appreciate Creative Control, again, please consider pledging a monthly amount. All of the info you need is at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thank you.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
In case you missed the last episode, I'm not really supposed to be here today. It's my day off. But there's no rest. I wanted to give you some new episodes, so here's another one. It's a good one. Slim Twig returns to the show. Slim Twig, a.k.a. Max Turnbull. Max is on the show to talk about his new record. Thank you for sticking with Twig, which is out on DFA Records. And we get into a whole bunch of other stuff about persona and perception. And I thought it was quite an interesting conversation. You're going to hear new music from the brand new Slim Twig record and other stuff too. So this is it, myself and Slim Twig. Once again, he was on the show before. It was good. This is better. This might even be better. Myself and Slim Twig. Enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Pizza Trocadero, the finest pizzeria in all of Guelph, Ontario. They've got delicious gourmet pizzas, or choose from an array of fresh ingredients and make whatever you like. Calzones, wings, panzerottis, salads, breadsticks, garlic bread. Pizza Trocadero has it all. You can find them at 7 Municipal Street in Guelph or visit them online at trocaderoguelph.ca. That's TrocaderoGuelph.ca. Call them at 519-829-2444. For pickup or delivery. That's Pizza Trocadero, a place of the good trade. Slim Twig is the moniker for a young man from Toronto named Max Turnbull, who is a noted actor and musician. Over the past 10 years or so, he has released a lot of challenging, artful pop music in projects like Tropics, Archaic Women, Plastic Factory, US Girls, Darlene Shrug, and, of course, Slim Twig. His most recent album is a challenging yet accessible blast of psych pop called Thanks for Stickin' with Twig, which is available via DFA Records. And here now for a chat about it is Slim Twig. Hey, Max, how's it going?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Where are you?
Well, I'm at Toronto. I'm at my parents' place, which is very near to where I live, but has the benefit of having internet, which I don't have at my house except on my phone. So when I want to be, you know, doing emails and stuff like that, I just pop by here.
Now, why don't you have the internet at your house? It is expensive. I assume that's the primary reason.
That's not the only reason. I don't want to be up until, you know, 3:30 in the morning looking at YouTubes, basically, when I'm at home with my wife. So it's sort of been handy not to have to pay the monthly fee for it. And also, I think it makes for a nicer home life. And, you know, everyone has internet on their phone anyway, so it's not as if I'm missing out on, you know, getting emails when they're sent or hearing about when Blue Jays have been traded or important things like that. So
right. This is wormhole prevention, basically.
Basically, yes. Yeah.
And did you find that you were addicted?
I think I have that capacity within me, for sure. I definitely can, you know, spend hours reading about sports teams that I like or checking out YouTubes of music that I'm interested in or, you know, things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think are valuable things to do, but it's good to kind of block out some time specifically for that rather than feeling, you know, like you're being pulled into some kind of wormhole, as you say.
Yeah, it's the way things work right now. I've done the same thing. I should be going to bed, but I just want to watch The Daily Show from the last night. So I go on to the web and I watch The Daily Show.
For sure. There's so many things that seem as if they're really important to get caught up with that kind of evaporate when you don't have immediate access to them, so.
And you've been okay, like you're okay with this. Everything's fine.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a permanent thing. Maybe as I get older, I'll develop, you know, better self-control with that stuff. So, but right now, it keeps me more productive and it keeps me reading, you know, words on actual pages more than screens. So
right.
It seems positive for the time being.
Right. Now, I know you're at your parents' house. So the first question that I wanted to ask you, I don't know how well you can answer it.
Mm-hmm.
What I have written down here is, do you like drugs?
Do I like drugs?
Well, you actually repeated the question so your parents could hear it.
Right. I did. It's true. I guess I'm not ashamed. actually, you know, I think my reputation sort of has started to precede me with that question a little bit in the last year, you know, probably since I dropped the song Cannabis and have made mention about, you know, wanting to make music that sort of emulates the tactile quality that we can experience music in while stoned, and wanting to kind of emulate that for people without them having to imbibe anything. So I can see that is sort of creeping into my sort of public image a little bit, but it's actually not something that's very central to me. My experience with drugs is very limited to, you know, pursuing smoking weed. And that has been something that has been an aid, I think, as far as hearing music and perceiving it differently and picking up on different things. So I guess I would be lying if I said I didn't like smoking weed and think that it should be legalized and all that stuff. But I'm by no means, you know, some kind of druggie and by no means someone who wants to be, you know, waving a pot leaf flag, basically.
Well, yeah, so what happened was on April 20th,
yes.
You released this single, Cannabis, and I think some people received, I was among them,
mm-hmm.
a 45 single of the single. Like, I received it in the mail from your label, I presume, and which was very kind.
Yeah.
But the label of the 45 is just, you know, these pot leaves. It seemed very pointed. I mean, why would you send out a song? I think you spoke to this. You just wanted to try to capture the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, how would people not pigeonhole you a little bit if you're sending out this pot single?
Well, you're suggesting that my single was wrapped in a pot leaf flag, are you?
Well, I mean, was it not? Wasn't the label kind of,
yeah,
it had a bunch
pretty
of
much is.
Pot,
I mean, yeah.
Pot iconography? Yeah.
I'm definitely open to talking about it, as long as it doesn't, decrease my ability to cross borders and so forth. There was a cheeky quality to doing that for sure. And for starters, I should clarify that the song Cannabis is actually a cover.
That's right. That's the other side of this, yeah.
Yeah, of a Serge Gainsbourg song. Of course, my affection for Serge Gainsbourg is well documented with, the last album that I released on DFA before this was, had connections to some of his work as well and was,
We talked about him quite extensively the last time you were on the show as well. Yeah, that's right.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, when I was making the record and realizing that a theme of the album was the sort of aided perception that weed can provide when listening to music or experiencing like films and imagery and just sort of that sort of transition of perspective that allows you to see things in a different light, that was sort of coming to me as a theme of the album. The Serge song Cannabis seemed to be very appropriate. It's one of my favorite instrumental arrangements of his, and I really wanted to sort of have my hand at coming up with a modernized or original arrangement of it, and it tying in with the themes with its title and everything like that. And it just seemed like kind of a funny, cheeky way to get people on board with hearing some of the new material. I'm not shying away from that association at all, but it's not how I identify. I don't put my music in the box of like stoner rock or something, very pigeonholed like that.
Right. You've touched upon a few things there about perception and even your own sort of wariness of being pigeonholed in any way. I feel like the last time we spoke, we got into this as well, because at one point people viewed you as this gothic rockabilly dude, and now you're presenting yourself in this other way, and also suddenly I'm hearing the beeping from you going in reverse a little bit. I feel like you are very self-conscious about how you're perceived, but at the same time, you're, I think, self-conscious about the way you are, maybe. You're presenting yourself in ways we're not, I don't think people external to you are foisting these things upon you. It seems to be part of you, but you seem wary of being known as just any one thing.
Well, for sure. And you can maybe appreciate why in the fact that, when I first was sort of getting my music out there, people were taking what I was putting out there, and then those sort of associations, like the rockabilly stuff or whatever, which, came about as a result of me, again, trying to be cheeky. Oh, what kind of music do you make? Well, it's concrete rockabilly,
Yeah.
Which was the idea of, like, I'm interested in suicide and, like, the iconography of, like, Elvis a little bit and stuff like that. But I'm also interested in Wu-Tang Clan and, like, sound-based, Black Dice kind of collage-y experimentation. How can I combine those worlds? Okay, it's concrete rockabilly. And from that moment on, it was almost like I was a roots rocker because of the way I was covered, was picking up on that one cue. So what I've kind of realized about myself and my approach is that I'm sort of like an anti-fundamentalist. I'm not any one thing fundamentally, and in fact, I can be convinced of pretty much any position, with enough, with a good enough argument, essentially. And my process is one that is constantly evolving. So I'm very wary of saying, yes, this is me definitely and forever, because people like in the media definitely pick up on that and they hammer those kind of cues to death. And I find that it just puts your music in a box, really. And it instead of attracting people that might be interested in hearing it, it actually serves the opposite purpose. Because writers think that they know you so well, they can just, make an X, Y, and Z equation for what you do. And that, might scare people off who may be interested in an approach that's more sort of evolution-based and is constantly in flux. And I can appreciate that that's not for everyone. And I don't think every artist is that way. I think that there are some artists who have very specific reference points or sensibilities or ideas that they spend their whole career sort of refining. But that I'm the opposite of that. So I'm always hedging my bets a little bit because, right now I'm being associated for, you know, with the long hair, as I once was associated with the pompadour and like the weed imagery and the guitar stuff. But I know that that's not forever. That's for right now. And
yeah.
The interesting thing is going to be drawing a line through all those things that I've done, even though the signifiers have completely shifted over time. And I think that, you know, very slowly I've been accumulating like fans of my music who are able to sort of consider it in more of a left brain and maybe more of a generous context, where they can see those connections that I'm drawing, even if they are a little bit opaque at times. But I think that I'm just interested in artists like that more so. So I, you know, model myself on an approach that is open to transformation.
I think that some of what you're referring to in terms of how you're covered by the media is a reference to print media, and it's by necessity there's always been this attempt to distill things for the sake of brevity. I mean, there's only so much room that there, in terms of print, there's only so much room to get and convey things. So writers, I don't think it's out of, for a long time it's been perceived as laziness, but I think it's just like, I only have 180 words to talk about this person.
Yeah.
What am I going to put forth in that? And inevitably, you're not going to get even a, you might get a little glimpse at them, but you might not get the whole thing. And then,
for sure.
But I think we're, you are referencing, I mean, we're in an age where with the internet, there's those print confines aren't as rigid, and instead you can actually have people who can really go expansively into an artist. So I don't know if you've noticed a shift that way. I mean, sure, the soundbite culture that you've been affected by, I think, is sort of melting as people get into more long-form discussion and consumption. Have you noticed any shift that way, or in
I can meet you halfway on that. I think it is true that a lot of times there only is so much space, particularly in the print media. But even so, that often translates less into having, you know, compressing information, and more so it appears as making formulations that define bands by their influences, which I just find to be, I don't want to say lazy, I just think it's sort of the common practice, you know. Journalism for music has turned into, like, trying to be a sleuth, basically, and, like, catching bands out on where they're picking up ideas from. And I will definitely concede that I think that style of writing takes its cue from music that is being produced, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of music that is very consciously trying to do that, is trying to sound exactly like this one record from 1977 by this one band. You know, there's so many, like, one of my biggest pet peeves is bands that are contemporary that say that, oh, we're a post-punk band, we're a krautrock band, we're, you know, a rockabilly band, we're like a 1977 style Australian punk band or whatever.
Sure.
I find it to be a kind of ludicrous notion. And I wish that more musicians would accept the fact that we are living in a time where access to the history of music is unprecedentedly easy to obtain. And so by that nature, I think people are more easily susceptible to those kinds of influences. But I think that there's still original things that can be done within that context. You know, there's such a long history of art making and music making where, in fact, I think the entire history of music making, which is some form of resampling and recontextualizing and cutting up and gluing onto other ideas or, you know, this kind of thing. So I think that there's a lot more room for that than a lot of musicians are presently making use of. And I think that when more people start sort of waking up to that and waking up to the idea that you can be referential, but that doesn't mean that you can't also have your own voice within that context, and that you don't have to treat your influences so slavishly and as if they're museum pieces that can't be disrupted, I think that we'll probably see some more interesting writing cropping up as a result of that. And right now, I think it's just those kinds of artists are a little bit marginalized. But I think that that's becoming less so, and I think that you're right, that the Internet is, while it does present a lot of challenges, it also is opening up conversations that are interesting. And, I think that there are positive things that can be drawn from that.
I think there is some laziness in the kind of, you know, what does your band sound like? Well, it sounds like this, or, hey, everyone, if you like such and such, you might like this. I think that there can be laziness in that. But I also think that in some cases, it's just trying to speak to a general audience, like, you know, an audience that might not know, let's say, Darlene Shrug, one of your other bands, that someone might say, and fully without ill intent, you know, it sounds like this. And unfortunately, sure, that follows you around. I don't know, maybe you're getting at the fact that we seem to kowtow to the non-music fan too much. I don't know.
I think you can make that argument, but I also think that that more general audience that you're speaking of, they also have a facility for or a common language of emotions and mm-hmm. and of vibes and of ideas, as well as a common language of, like, you know, the classic rock textbook or whatever. So I think that you can still reach those people, even in small sound bites, by talking about the feelings that music evokes in you, rather than, you know, what kind of guitars and what kind of amps they like to use that have in common with whatever, you know, garage rock legend or something like that.
Right.
So I just wish that the discourse was a little bit shifted to represent that even bands that are referential, they're trying to evoke a particular energy. And I think that could be discussed in a way that is very accessible as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting into, this is a whole other conversation about, I think, our collective obsession with the past, our collective sort of sense of memory. Just this idea of, like, remember that, like, we're all just constantly trying to document everything so that we remember it.
Yeah.
And then in a sense, we like to talk about those memories as, you know, touchstones in our lives. But
sure,
it does become complicated. As I say, a longer conversation. Yeah. I think this is interesting, but I want to talk to you more about your record.
Okay, sure.
The record is called Thanks for Sticking with Twig. There's obviously...
Oh, thank you.
Oh, sorry, thank you. I read it, but thank you. Thank
That's
you.
All right.
Did I say it wrong in the... in the thing? Wait a second. I think the promo I'm just going to look at my phone because I don't want to seem like a chump here.
No, not at all. I have seen it online as Thanks for Sticking with Twig.
I think that's what the promo I got said. That's why I wrote it down. Hang on a second. Let me just make sure. I just want to see who's right.
Sure.
I believe that you are right. I believe that. I got Thanks for Sticking with Twig. That's what they sent me.
No, I can totally believe that. I wouldn't assume that to be a chumpy mistake. I just want to clarify, you know?
Okay, thank so it's you. Actually thank you for
it's
sticking
even
with
more
Twig.
Personal
it's
than
more
just thanks.
That's right. It's more personal. So, what I was going to say is there's obvious gratitude within your album title. What mm-hmm. what prompted that? What prompted you to convey that?
Well, first of all, the album title is a pun, so that's always a positive in my book. Second of all, you know, this record for me was the first record after a certain era. I feel like A Hound at the Hem sort of closed out an era for me of working, you know, primarily in a localized sense, you know, on a Canadian label, playing my shows primarily in Toronto or Canada and stuff like that. And I feel like that album kind of was the thing that kind of transformed that dynamic for me and has allowed me to kind of think on a different level with music. So this was sort of the first new record for me, in a sense. And so I wanted to, you know, thank that scrappy sort of handful of people that maybe have stuck with me from, like, the very first stuff when I was making Concrete Rockabilly mixtapes and putting them up for free on the internet and this kind of thing. So, and I also thought it would just be sort of a cheeky thing to direct my sort of some thanks in the album title specifically to, like, a handful of people that is probably like 25 people, let's be honest here. I thought it would be kind of just a funny thing to do. I liked the conversational aspect of the title. I like this idea of, you know, pretending I'm more of a star than I am. I think that's a facet of my personality. That's something that is ripe for a little bit of you know, making fun of myself a little bit.
And yeah.
I think that with this album, I have sort of been trying to expand my approach in a number of different directions, and one of them has been to try and incorporate a little more humor and to take the piss out of myself a little bit. A lot of my work has been so self-serious up to this point, you know, like a concept album, like based on a Vladimir Nabokov novel, you know, this kind of thing. I thought it was time for a little bit of levity. Not to suggest that the music itself is entirely comical. I think there's elements of humor in it, but you know, that was all kind of wrapped up in the title.
Does the title feed into the intention of any of these songs specifically? I mean, I know you, like, in the song Live In, Live On Your Era, you kind of sing about yourself in like a third-person way.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not sure if that happens elsewhere. You just sort of reference Slim Twig as a moniker.
I mean, a lot of the songs have to do with they're all to do with my own personal experience or my ideas on certain things. So it is definitely a personal record, even if only the one song is from that sort of explicit perspective. What was the question again?
Well, I was just curious if that idea of expressing gratitude is conveyed within the songs itself, or is it just a wink and a nod in the title?
That's a good question. I do genuinely feel a sense of gratitude to anyone who has continued to pay attention to my music and to remain in the conversation with me, because I know that it's not easy. I was saying before, I see myself as the anti-fundamentalist, and I think that there's an amount of whiplash that comes with following my music, because basically from one album to the next, there isn't much resemblance at many, or kind of coherence or like a stability, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I admire in other artists when it crops up and think is interesting, but I can totally appreciate that it's harder to follow for sort of a casual listener. Like, what is this guy doing? What's he getting at? What is he trying to refine? What is his message? All of those remain very ambiguous. So I do genuinely feel gratitude for anyone who's sort of...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Stuck it out with me. At the same time, it is cheeky because I feel as if there are so few of those people. So, is it? I guess that's kind of the definition of tongue in cheek. You know, there is a certain amount of genuineness in it, and also like an ironic element that undercuts it a little bit. So that's just totally in keeping with how I like to keep things off balance, I guess.
Yeah. If there is consistency within all of your work, and I know you mentioned that on some level there really isn't, but I do think at the end of the day you are a pop songwriter, but you tend to present your hooks, your melodies, and these distorted, somewhat challenging sounding songs. And I mean, they've taken various shapes and forms, as you mentioned, and that's true. Anyone can look at the records and see that. But,
but
you kind of work as a pop tunesmith type dude, but kind of incognito. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, for sure.
And why are you kind of in disguise? Why do you choose to kind of submerge the hook of the possible infectiousness of your songs? I mean, I think it's still there.
Yeah.
But it requires I think a bit more delving. If it was.
Yeah.
Anyway, can you speak to that?
It's difficult. When I was making Hound of the Hem, I was like, man, this is a totally catchy pop record. This is like, man, who's not going to be into this? This is going to throw me on top of the charts, you know? And I think I always have that delusion when I'm making my records. Like, each new record that I make, I think, is the most accessible thing I've done so far. So, I don't know. I guess I'm just suffering from a bit of a delusion. I'm certainly not trying to make things more complicated than they need be. That's just my voice. It's full of digression and uncertainty and a sort of searching quality.
When you demo these songs, if you demo these songs, presumably maybe on your own, mm-hmm. and they kind of come, I don't know, do you demo these songs in any kind of dry format before all of this stuff kind of comes through on the records? Do you know what I mean?
I've started to do that a lot more, and on the new record I did that for a lot of the songs, for sure. But I think that is a good question, because I think that is part of it. A lot of the material that I've released, and Hound at the Hem being one of them, the songs were created as I was recording them. So the parts didn't really exist until, you know, I decided that it was the day to record the piano for this song or whatever. So I think that maybe contributes to it. A lot of it is done on the fly. And, you know, when I was first coming up, like, I used to have a very pretentious term for what I was trying to do, which was song sculpting, you know, instead of songwriting, because it wasn't like I was sitting down with an acoustic guitar out in the woods like Neil Young, you know, this is the chord progression for the verse, this is the chord progression for the chorus.
Right.
It was very much more on the fly and more intuitive. Not to say that process can't be intuitive either, but far from being sort of a perfectionist and nailing down these hooks or something, it was just sort of take me where the recordings want to go.
I think that regardless of what you do, there's an enigmatic quality, it seems. I mean, you're drawn to this idea of making things that are clearly melodic, but kind of offsetting that access on some level. You know, that their accessibility is sort of shrouded in something,
mm-hmm.
whatever tone you are currently fixated on, I think. I mean, as we've discussed, the records shift and change.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, it's you. I mean, I think that you have developed, despite the fact that you're anti-fundamentalist, I think you have some idiosyncrasies that come through for people following your trajectory.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, I guess I'm pushing for a Slim Twig Unplugged album.
Well, you know, I think I'm getting closer and closer to that being a reality. I am actually feeling drawn more to the idea of that kind of singer-songwriter with his acoustic guitar banging out the structure and getting the arrangements just so and getting the studio musicians in the studio. I'm definitely, with each passing album, moving more and more into that direction.
Hmm.
So I'm hoping that my music can retain those sort of idiosyncrasies and a quality that isn't obvious for people, that is more on the tip of the tongue than it is knowing exactly where my influences are coming from, that mm-hmm. is a little bit more original, if I can say that, but is more accessible and can be appreciated in sort of a traditional sort of song-like structure. You know, I would like to be in a place like a Lou Reed or a David Bowie or a Beck or a Nick Cave or something like that, you know.
See, you're doing it again. You got to be careful. You can't cite the people that you want to be like, and then when we in the media say, you know, he kind of seems like this seems to be where he's at, you can't be like, hey, no, guys, settle down. Don't say that.
With the exception of Bowie, none of those guys are explicit influences on me. I'm just more trying to say, like, listen, this is the kind of song person I want to be, someone who is making stuff that is uncompromising and is coming from an original voice that has things to say.
And is dynamic, right?
Really, like, recognized within, like, the traditional structure of songwriting and storytelling, and not just some weirdo on the fringe.
Sure.
So I'm less trying to say, like, you know, listen to these guys' records, then you'll really see where I'm coming from. I literally, there's nothing in common between my music right now and what Nick Cave does. Nothing.
Except that you cite shapeshifters. You are intrigued by people who can put forth a dynamic catalog of music and still, you know, I think retain a fan base, take people on that journey with them. You know, there's people reject stuff like that. Oh, the new Bowie is all techno, whatever. I mean, I'm sure that happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then the people reevaluate. I don't know. I think I know where you're coming from.
But I agree with you. I think that's a good impulse that you have to say, what are you doing? You're, you know, contradicting what you're saying. And I agree that a problem that I have is trying to express the vision in a way where, like, I'm just talking a mile a minute and really trying to, like, communicate all the references and get everyone on board with this. And I think that's not necessarily an approach that serves what I'm after exactly.
Yeah.
And a little bit more mystery might help. But, you know, at my core, I really want to be liked and I really want my music to be appreciated. And I think that comes out almost as a weakness at times.
Well, it sounds like you're doing jobs that shouldn't be part of your job. I mean, just anytime anyone gets into some kind of control of a message about themselves, I mean, that's the no-win proposition. There's not really, no one really, maybe Donald Trump can do it. I don't know if anyone can really do that and be satisfied and sleep well knowing, you know, anyway, this gets into a whole other knot of like, how much do you really divulge in an interview? Or a conversation about your work. I mean, shouldn't the work stand for itself?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Anyway.
But, and the ultimate, not to like go into this whole knotted argument as you're suggesting, but the end game is like, why do an interview ever then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I know. And that would put me out of, I'm not really in business per se, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
I think that articulating your thoughts about, I mean, we've talked about a whole whack of things here, so I don't know that we have really, you know, done too much work on over-explaining the record. It's more of where you're coming from. Anyway, I think that there's value in these things too. It just, I think that once you let go of the fact that, and I think a lot of artists are good at letting go of the fact that external perceptions or external interpretations shouldn't really color what they're doing. And I think that you are, in any time we've spoken, you're very self-aware. But I think at some level I can also hear you letting go of it a little bit.
I'm trying. Yeah. It's not a position that comes naturally to me. I really want people to like get it, you know? And I think it would be positive for me to let go of that inclination a little bit and to worry more about the next direction and less how, you know, the present one is being parsed.
Right. So. Absolutely. That's right. I have one more album question. There's a recurring interpolation? What? Yes, a recurring interpolation on the record falls within You Got Me Going and Out of My Mind. What is up with that?
Well, there's a song by a group called the Chi Lights. It's called Stoned Out of My Mind, and it's a love song. You know, where the singer of the song just says, "You've got me going, stoned out of my mind." I just love the song, basically, and wanted to have a piece that could drift through the album and be, you know, provide a little bit of cohesion between the two sides, because I think that the record itself contains a lot of different styles of music and atmospheres.
Yeah.
So something that could kind of hold the two sides together for those people who are listening on the preferred format.
What is the vintage of that band?
They are like a soul band from the 70s. They may have started in the later 60s, too.
Right, but they hit their stride. Is this song from the 70s?
Yep.
Right.
And it was a hit for them. They're like they're a soul group, and they're fantastic.
Now, I don't want to delve too far into this, given all that we've discussed in terms of pointing people to anything, but I think some people will hear this record and get this 70s sense.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you want to bother speaking to that? I mean, is this era in particular significant for you?
Yeah, for sure it is. Well, a lot of my favorite music came out in that era, and it's been very fertile ground for me as far as picking up ideas that I like and inspirations, for sure. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. Everyone has their touchstones. Mine just happened to be constantly shifting, and the 70s was definitely a huge one for this record.
You seem to be, I mean, again, to oversimplify this, but you seem to be cycling through, if we actually look at the way people have interpreted your music, you seem to be going decade by decade right now.
Yeah.
you came out and you were the 50s kind of, you know, whatever guy, and I think there's probably some 70s stuff there. And now, yeah, we're sort of entering this. I mean, with this, I want to ask a little bit about this amazing band you're in, Darlene Shrug.
Yeah.
It does seem like, yeah, there's that even the way you're, again, not trying to paint you in a corner, but the mm-hmm. way you've been kind of aesthetically, like the way you've been dressing a little bit and the way that mm-hmm. you've, the guitar rock that you've been making in Darlene and Shrug,
mm-hmm.
very, very evocative of parts of aspects of the 1970s.
Yeah, I mean, I think the 70s and, you know, the 60s you can definitely include in there too, was a time when I think rock music was holding a lot of cultural capital. And because I'm trying to be a rock and roller in the 21st century, of course I'm going to be looking to that era when people were reading a lot of substance into records that were coming out in a rock capacity. And I wish that that would sort of return, and I think it won't return until people start putting substance into their rock songs again. And Megan and I have, like, sort of talked a lot about that over the past year, about trying to make songs that are substantial. You know, I've talked about this new record being a protest album of sorts, and I think, like, a lot of the songs touch on issues more obliquely than maybe like an early Bob Dylan protest song would, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, there's a lot of, I'm trying to address a lot of inequalities, some of them personal and ego-based and some of them broader and more universal than that. So I think that's why I feel a lot of affinity for guitar music of that era, for one thing. And also, you know, everyone has to pick their influences, and it's a matter of what you do after that. And I think that this record in particular, the Twig record, I think that it transcends that influence. And I think that if you really spend time with it, pay attention to all facets of it, the, you know, the production of it, the lyrics of it, there's a lot more meat on the bone than just a sort of tribute to the 70s. Like, there's only two songs with live drums on the record. The rest is, like, programmed stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, that may sound like some kind of superficial difference. But I think that, mixed with the combination of how many different styles and vibes there are, and just a sort of sense of production that is very era ambiguous.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
It's, you know, a fusion of digital and analog stuff. So I think that there's a case to be made that, sure, it has influences that are present. A lot of them sort of classic influences, perhaps, but that it transforms those. And I'm hoping that people pick up on that and don't see me as sort of a retro rocker or revisionist or something like that. I'm trying to speak to modern people about contemporary issues with this record. So I hope that comes through.
Okay. No, I think it does. And I think you've explained that rather well. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with Darlene Shrug? This is a band that I've only seen the one time. Mm-hmm. It was at A Long Winter in February, maybe, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away. I think I went on Instagram. It was like, this is a best new Toronto band alert. I said something stupid like that, but I meant it. I really loved it. And I wonder what's going on with that project.
It's very active. You know, we're recording our record right now. We were in a very fancy studio for a couple of days this month with Young Gov from Fucked Up.
Ben Cook, yeah.
Helping us out there. I don't know, that band, like, initially, you know, started to sort of take on the work that Tropics was doing, the band that I was in with Simone TB for 10 years, and I just felt totally exhausted and burnt out from trying to make massive sounding rock music with just two people. But I still, you know, Simone and I still had a very important relationship and wanted to continue to play music together. So that was sort of like the impetus behind starting it. And it was like, who do we want to play with? We want to play with Amanda, Carlin, and Meg. Those are the people that we want to make music with.
Mm-hmm.
So once we got in a room, like, it just turned into something else completely. And it turned into, like, a really legitimate band with its own energy and just everyone feeding off of each other, and a chemistry developed that was completely unforeseen and kind of blindsided, you know, certainly Simone and I think everyone in the band. And it's been a really incredible experience being in that band. It's totally, you know, I thought of, like, the Twig record in some sense as being the solo album from the dude who's in that band.
See, it does kind of come across that way. When I've heard the new Twig, I was just like, oh, like, this is just a zone you're in.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can't understate the influence of being in that band on my approach and my direction, really. So I sort of thought of the Twig record as like these are kind of like the weird cuts that would maybe be a little bit outside of the purview of the really heavy rock and roll band.
Yeah.
You know, like a weird solo record from a dude who's in a crazy rock and roll band.
That hasn't released their album yet.
Yeah, well, you know, I just do things backwards, I guess. But the record's going to be massive. It's just crazy boogie music for 21st century. And, you know, I'm just so pleased that people are picking up on this energy, because I am feeling how special the energy is when we play live, and just the reaction we're getting. It's like by far and away the best band I've ever been in. So
the chemistry is kind of palpable. Like, this is a unique confluence of people, I think, and I hope that people check it out. You mentioned that when did you go to the studio? Just like last?
This past month, yeah.
Past month.
Tracked like eight songs and, you know, working on piecing it together now.
Okay, so there's no timeline on anything?
No, it's more casual in that sense, you know, like everyone is committed to all kinds of other pieces of music who's in that band. So, you know, there's a lot of like, I have this record coming out that I'm hoping to promote, and there's a new US Girls record that will be promoted well, and you know, Ice Cream have a record that will be coming out at some point. So I think when that stuff dies down a little bit, the record will come out, and it will definitely come out in 2016.
Okay. And what is, I'm familiar with US Girls. What is Ice Cream? I feel like I know Ice Cream, but I can't.
Ice Cream, they're great. It's Carlin, who plays shredding lead guitar in Darlene Shrug, and Amanda, who plays bass. They're a duo as well as being in Darlene Shrug. And they call it molecular pop. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but
okay.
It employs a lot of synthesizer and beats and, you know, kind of robotic, mechanical, but slightly sensual, weird music. I don't know. It's cool.
Nice. That sounds cool. All right. Now, you mentioned those things. Are there any other future collaborations, videos, releases that we can expect sometime soon? What's next for you? Oh, and tour dates? What's going on? I don't actually know what's happening.
Yeah, I'm going on tour mid-September for a month or so. I'll be hitting up all kinds of spots in Canada and the U.S. I'm hoping to also visit Europe by the end of the year. There'll be new videos and stuff like that. I have a song I produced on the new U.S. Girls record that'll be released, I think, sometime in August. Stuff like that.
Okay. This is nothing forthcoming immediately. You've got this record to worry about.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's pretty much it.
All right. That's cool. Well, once again, the new Slim Twig record is called Thank You for Sticking with Twig, or depending on how you've downloaded it, it might just be thanks, but apparently it's called Thank You for Sticking with Twig, and it's available via DFA Records. You can learn
and cassette via Pleasance Records.
Oh, it's on cassette as well.
Yeah, for
nice.
Sure.
Pleasance Records. Okay, there you go. You can learn more about it at, well, dfarecords.com, slim-twig.com, and just Google Pleasance Records. I don't know their Earl.
If you're a cassette head, just Earl it up. Pleasance Records.
Is there a song from this record that we can go to right now, Max?
Yes, Fog of Sex.
Fog of Sex. Now, why did that come to mind?
There we go. It's very hot up in here, where in the second floor of my parents' place. So maybe that's why.
You just thought of, okay, that makes sense. Have you had a lot of foggy sex at your parents' house?
You know, I lived here for quite a time, so it's quite possible.
All right, this is Fog of Sex by Slim Twig. Max, I appreciate you being back on the show. I like talking to you. You're a thoughtful dude, and I wish you the best of luck with everything going forward.
All right, I'm sure I'll run into you some point soon in the future.
Hey, thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K, control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And you can listen to that online at CFRU.ca, or if you're in the KW region, at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkana.com, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.